Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted because with us today is Ruth Abram, president of Behold New Lebanon. Behold New Lebanon is a new type of living museum without walls and celebrates and explores contemporary rural American life. The mission of Behold New Lebanon is to offer the public unprecedented access to contemporary rural American life, its people, their skill, ingenuity, and heritage, pioneering a new concept in community economic development. It models an expanded role for museums in American culture. Inspired by 250 years of innovative rural life in New Lebanon, New York, the citizens here are again pioneering a new idea. The nation's first living museum of contemporary rural American life, Behold New Lebanon, shares with visitors the heritage, skills, techniques, and know-how of generations past, building a bridge between a rich history and a sustainable future. You may have visited historic museums where costumed docents play characters from yesteryear and demonstrate skills of times long since past, but at Behold New Lebanon, you visit real people and learn how they live, work, and play at their farms, barns, artisan studios, workshops, businesses, and wooded trails. These are farmers, florists, beekeepers, auto mechanics, car racers, gardeners, homesteaders, cattle breeders, foragers, toy makers, herbalists, naturalists, singers, volunteer firefighters, hunters, writers, quilters, bakers, and much more. Behold New Lebanon was recently named a recipient of New York J.M. Kaplan Innovative Prize. The $175,000 award recognizes founder Ruth Abram for leadership and dedication to social innovation. And now Ruth is receiving another prestigious honor, the Herbert H. Lehman Prize for Distinguished Service to New York History from the New York Academy of History. However, Ruth Abram is perhaps better known as the founding president of Manhattan's Lower East Side Tenement Museum. We'll talk to Ruth Abram about all of this. But first, welcome, Ruth Abram.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And this is not the first conversation we've had, and I look forward to learning a great deal. Let's start with what you're best known for, the New York City Tenement Museum. Now, I have to say that my mother was born on Rivington Street. So this is pretty important stuff to me. Tell us about the Tenement Museum.
Well, the Lower East Side Tenement Museum is a building. It's in a building built in 1863 by a German-born tailor who thought it quite good enough for him to move in with his family, because when he built it in 1863, the choice for working-class families in New York were houses that had been divided into lots of little warrens. So this was a great improvement on working class housing. Over the years, it would deteriorate and tenements would become synonymous with housing for the poor. The building between 1863 when it opened and 1935 when it closed held, according to our scholars, an estimated 7,000 people.
Whoa.
From over 20 nations.
Where'd they go to the bathroom?
Well, at first, they went outside in the courtyard in four privies that were there, and they drew their water from a spigot.
And how many floors
there
is this place now?
Six.
Wow.
Yep.
So in the middle of the night, if you're like me and you get up, you got to go down six floors and then back up six floors.
Well, you'd probably go in the chamber pot.
A chamber pot,
yes,
of course.
Exactly. And then you take it out in the morning. So that's how that worked. But, you know, one of the interesting things you raise about where you go to the bathroom is that the argument over putting bathrooms into the tenement, which happened in 1905, the biggest critics of this were the tenants themselves, the immigrant tenants. They said, how dare the landlord put the function of the bathroom inside our house? They felt it was much better outside. After all, they're used to in their countries going in the woods or in outhouses way out back. And the idea of mixing these things was just horrible to them.
In other words, if you relieved yourself in the house, it was somehow
unsanitary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they felt.
Yeah. So tell me how you got started with the whole thing. How did you decide to do the Tenement Museum, which you have been so lauded for?
Well, I really have had a career which had, when I looked at it, an issue that joined everything I'd done together, which is, how will we be one nation and at the same time enjoy, appreciate, and certainly not be afraid of really often profound differences we bring to the table? And I thought that I'd like to get at that issue through a museum because I had come to believe that history could open up people's consciousness in a way that other things might not be able to, certainly not preaching, for instance. So the idea was that I would try to look at that question through the lives of immigrants and remind Americans that the immigrants they were meeting in the Tenement Museum, in carefully conceived furnished apartments set in a particular time in that family's life, were exactly the same in so many regards as the people who are today walking the streets of New York and elsewhere who have just arrived.
So how did you get it right? I remember going into Freud's house, and they said, well, not every piece of furniture was exactly what Freud had, but we pretty well reproduced it. Did you do that in the Tenement Museum?
Yes, because, of course, the immigrants didn't have fine furnishings. So by the time we came around, they wouldn't have saved that furniture from 1863. Sure. Their families, when they prospered, would have thrown it out and got sure. other things unless they were family heirlooms. Imagine bringing a whole chair over from Europe in steerage. You just wouldn't. But what we did do, we had a wonderful, wonderful curator, Pamela Keach, who really channeled the family. She thought, what would Mrs. Gumpertz, a German Jew in 1873 in the midst of a depression, what could she afford to buy? And what did the furnishings of that time look like? And so then she would put it together. She knew she was a seamstress, so she had to have a sewing machine. She knew she had to have a model for clothing. She knew she had three children, so the bedding was there. And on until she felt she'd gotten it right. And with one of the apartments, with the Sicilian family, who was there at the very end of the building's history in the Great Depression, the Baldizi family, we had the great good fortune of having Josephine Baldizi with us. And she had been a child in that apartment. And she remembered it as it was yesterday. And that reminds me that for Josephine Baldizi and for all the people we met who had lived in the tenements and who now live either in the Bronx or Brooklyn or Long Island, they all say and said to us that they would never want this experience for their children because it was very hard, very hard. But they have never, ever again been able to experience community in the way they did in those tenements. So I thought that was a very interesting insight.
In the 1950s, my father would load us into his car and bring us all down to Orchard Street, and we would buy all of our underwear and stuff like that. But there basically is not that anymore. It's gone.
Right.
But the museum's there. And did you find that a lot of people waxed emotional when they saw it?
We actually had to train our staff in what to do when people wept because it was sort of shocking to them. You know, they weren't telling a sad story, but they were telling a real story, and people really resonated. They brought their own family stories to it in their minds, and sometimes they told them so that we were taught by the visitors, and we taught the visitors, and often it just brought them to tears, which meant that they'd been really deeply touched, and
so
that was
great. So the docents had a spiel, right?
They told the story of the family whose story they were telling. It wasn't a written-down spiel that they had to memorize. They learned the family story, and each tells it in a different way. And some of our most popular guides are immigrants themselves who weave in their own story with the story, and they're often asked by visitors, well, tell us about you, you know, because did you ever live in a place like this? And so many did.
Yeah.
And immigrants coming through as visitors were enthralled. And at one point, we had a class of immigrants learning English, and they started speaking in Spanish, not knowing our guides spoke fluent Spanish. And one said to the other, looking at the peeling wallpaper and the bare bulb, and all these pieces of the tenement building, and said, they call this a museum? And then they got
Where's
up
the
into
Van Gogh?
That's right. And then they got up into the apartment, and all we could hear is, "Well, this is how we live." So the thought that somebody was honoring their experience as an experience worthy of being a museum was just fascinating to them.
Well, you know, I've talked to a lot of people. I'm old now. I'm 74, soon to be 75, and I remember talking to a lot of people who came out of the Lower East Side.
Yes.
And hearing their stories. And I was always sort of fascinated because inevitably there would be talk about the dissonance between the various groups. the Italian kids who beat up the Jewish kids or along those lines. And I'm wondering, you tell a story about how the tenements housed everybody.
Mm-hmm.
What about this dissonance?
What about the friction? It was certainly there. You know, at some points in time, 97 Orchard Street, this tenement, housed, say, almost all Romanians. And another time...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Or another time, maybe more Germans. But then at various times, there was Germans and Irish and Italians and Jews. So, and then there were Sephardic Jews, and then there were Eastern European and...
And the subsects of, for example, Judaism didn't always get along.
Yes, we had it, one of the families whose story is told is the Confinos from Greece, and they were Sephardic Jews. They spoke Ladino, not Yiddish.
Ladino.
And they complained that they were not accepted by the Yiddish-speaking Jews in the building. So that's another story. It's really minorities within minorities, which is a very interesting story. And with every story, the Tenement Museum has made a point of trying to extract from that story the issue that is similar today. So for the Confinos, it is. What about, say, Cubans, Puerto Ricans?
I was about to go there.
Yes.
So what if, I mean, what's the lesson now? We have Donald Trump running for president saying, let's keep the Muslims out. Were there ever any Muslims in those in the museum?
Not at this time. It was condemned as a residence in 1935, and there was not a Muslim population that we know of there then. So.
Yeah. But what about the concept of tolerance?
Well, I think that the fact is that in every era, there's some group or groups that are scapegoated. And you can hear, you can read the diatribes against each of these groups in
the
turn.
The Irish, the Jews.
Yes. And often they were called black, which was fascinating. You know, it really shows you that race
Irish.
is a construct, not, you know, nothing else. It means bad, and that's really what it came to mean.
And when you're shepherding the folks through the building and showing them all of this, does this stuff ever come up, the dissonance?
Yes. We're not in any way papering over any of the aspects that were there. So people asked, did they get along? We don't know, you know, because we don't have the kind of research we did, even when it includes families, won't necessarily bring up who they didn't like in the building. However, people, you know, have fights and fuss at each other. So why wouldn't that happen? But we do know, for instance, we found recipes in Jewish households, obviously from their Italian neighbors and vice versa. So the women, at least, were exchanging how-tos and things to do, and I'm sure they sat for each other's children. So they needed each other in a way that we may not understand today.
Need will do that.
Yeah.
Okay, Ruth Abram, let's talk a little about you. Where were you born? How many siblings do you have? What did your mother and father do?
I'll tell you that, but I have one more story about,
please,
in answer to your question about where we got the information. My favorite was that when we got to the turn of the century, you know, immigrants didn't have their pictures taken in their tenement apartments. If they were having a special occasion, I'm sure if you have family pictures, they're in a studio with everybody dressed up, lined up by the person taking the photographer. And so it wasn't like the rich who had photographs of their homes. How are we going to know what they looked like in turn of the century? So one day, a contingent of police officers came in, and they were carrying crime photos. And when Teddy Roosevelt was police commissioner, photography was just coming out as a police tool, a crime-fighting tool. And they brought us pictures of tenement apartments with somebody's head in an oven or somebody knifed in the chest, lying on the floor, or, you know, double suicides, horrible scenes. And they must have been shocked as we looked and said, oh, look how they decorate with calendars. Oh, look at the lace curtains. Oh, look at how they hung where they put the lamp, or look how they arrange the furniture. And that was enormously helpful. So your information about these things comes from unexpected sources. And the other thing, in answer to your question about dissonance, not only did we make a point of talking about dissonance, but we made a point of talking about mistakes. So we got the wrong wallpaper in one of the apartments, only discovering it later. We were wrong about writing on the wall what it actually was, only discovered later. And so we added that to the tours. We got it wrong, because that is the way history happens. You think you've got it, you say this what it is, and then you're proved wrong. You've got to explain that history is unraveling like an onion peel. So
Well, it's a brilliant concept, and you've been honored and feted, you know, for what you did. But at some point you decided, well, you know, I've done this now, I'm going to do something else. Mm-hmm. How come?
Well, I had taken the tenement from an idea, often with great opposition, to a finished, you never finish, but to a product that was stable and recognized and appreciated and understood as one of the icons of New York City. So I felt I had done my job, and I decided, I told the board I wanted to find a great successor.
But you didn't have founder's syndrome, which means I'm never leaving till they carry me out.
I knew about the founder's syndrome, and I really didn't want to put the museum into that position. And I knew that whoever came after me, I would, if I were there, I would say, oh, well, they didn't do it my way. And I didn't want to do that to anyone. So I did withdraw pretty completely. I'm emerita, told the new director who I helped select, who's just been great, you know, I'm here if you need me, you know, call when if you do. And really don't have much to do with the Tenement Museum now except supporting it in any way I can when asked.
So why did you move to New Lebanon, New York?
We moved to New Lebanon because my husband got a job in Albany, and he and I felt we'd like to live together. So we moved closer to Albany. And
you were the trailing spouse?
Yeah, I was the trailing spouse. And we found New Lebanon because we found a beautiful home that had been developed and designed for and by the Rickey family. George Rickey was a known sculptor in the area. And we just loved it, so we bought the house. And a very funny thing happened shortly after that. I said to my husband, I think we should now go see what New Lebanon is, because we didn't know. And we went down the street, and at the end of our street, we found a city dump. There were turned over cars, and there was trash everywhere, and oh, it was just a mess. And we were so horrified that we couldn't bring ourselves to say, what have we done? And then the next week we went, and it had gone away. And it turned out to have been the set for Woodstock, the film.
That's a riot.
And then we thought it was, we were doomed to live next to the city dump, but it was good. At any rate, we love the house, and we love being in New Lebanon, but what happened after a while, I worked a little bit for the Shaker Museum and did seminars for them on Shaker thought, which interests me.
How did you learn about that? How did you know about that?
Well, I'm in the museum world, so you tend to know what museums are around, and I looked first about that. And then I studied up on Shaker thought, and it was very interesting to me. I think the Shakers are one of the most interesting utopian groups in the world. And Were, yes. Well, they're three left, I think.
Yeah, they hardly reproduce.
Well, you know, that is not what killed them off in the end. They are the longest-lived utopian group, even though they were celibate. And do you know why they were celibate?
No.
Well, they were founded at a time when it was many, many, many people believed that the world was coming to an end and God would recreate God's kingdom on earth. And many people all over, particularly in New York State, were getting ready for that moment and trying to perfect themselves so that when God came and they were asked, are you perfect? Is your society perfect? They could say yes. The Shakers were way out front. They said, oh, no, no, the kingdom's already been established and we're it.
But they didn't want to procreate. They didn't want to.
No, because. Yeah. As angels, they kept asking, what would God want? And they, for instance, they said, would God want us to treat men and women differently? And they said no. So they had co-leaders, male and female, from the get-go. They said, would God want us to treat races differently? No. And they had black members and leaders. And they said, would God want us to believe and practice possession of another human being in any way, certainly not slavery? And then they said, what about possessiveness? What about jealousy? And they said no. And the way that they chose to limit that was to say no sex. Because if you have sex with a person, you are more, and you have a particular relationship with that person, you are more likely to feel ownership.
But didn't they know that eventually they'd put themselves out of business, or did they think the Messiah would come before that?
Well, they felt the Messiah was there, and it was Anne Lee, their leader, in female form.
So in other words, they didn't have to worry about
appropriation. They did not. No, they didn't. And they did take in orphans, lots of orphans. Remember, this was a time with very few so many deaths of parents or so many
and
times.
What years
parents.
Are you talking about here?
1790 it starts.
Uh-huh.
And New Lebanon was their headquarters. So
wow.
It was really quite an important place and an important museum with a wonderful new director. The first director, David Stocks, did a great job of stabilizing the buildings and properties. And I think the new director is going to really bring it alive with programming. So very exciting.
Extraordinary. And
yes.
Specifically that big round barn.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. So many beautiful things. But that was another thing. The Shakers believed that every piece of work was a prayer. And that's why it's so beautiful.
Really interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So I wanted to get a little bit on the record about you, about
okay.
how all of that began. Who were your parents? Who were your siblings? Where were you born?
Yeah.
Where were you raised?
I was born in Orange County, California, because my dad was a major in the Army and the Army base there. He was in charge of PR for the Army there. And then we moved to Atlanta, Georgia, where I was raised. And I have...
Now, what were your parents' religions?
My father was Jewish and my mother came from a Christian family, but my mother wasn't particularly interested in being religious and neither was my father. But we were raised as Jews, nominally.
Because, how'd that happen?
Well, first of all, we were raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and in the 1950s, even had we said we weren't Jewish, which would have been denounced, nobody would have believed that. You got labeled in the South at this time. And there was enormous prejudice at the time.
Against Jews.
Yes, yes. So my father certainly didn't want to back down from that, and he had great respect for prophetic Judaism, the Judaism that equates the practice of Judaism with justice.
But there's a general theory, isn't there, that Jews don't become army majors?
Well, he did. He came from a little teeny town, Fitzgerald, Georgia, 4 hours driving time south of Atlanta. Its fame was that this teeny town, at the end of the Civil War, there was a kind of drought, I think in Iowa, and it was mostly Union soldiers, but the people of Fitzgerald trying to populate their town offered to take in these Union soldiers, so they came. And the town has two main streets, Lee and Grant. One hotel, the Lee Grant, and one museum, the Blue and the Gray. And that's the town my dad grew up in. So he didn't grow up in a Jewish community. So he hadn't learned about Jewish practices.
Was he the only Jew in the town?
One of, I think, 12 in the whole town.
And everybody owned a store?
Pretty much. My grandfather owned a dry goods store. Yeah. Yes, he was from Romania, and he was illiterate in English.
Wow. Okay, so how old were you when you left that little town?
I didn't live there. He'd lived there.
Oh, I see.
He went on to University of Georgia and University of Chicago for law school.
So you became a lawyer.
Yes.
How did that influence you?
Well, my father was not only a lawyer, he was really quite a wonderful speaker, and I learned to speak with him, listening to him speak. He was a fierce advocate for civil rights. And he often represented blacks in these small towns at some, with some danger. And he and my mother.
He was sort of, you know.
He was a civil rights attorney for a lot of his practice.
A civil rights attorney. And so contemporary novels, you know, which extol that, become part of your history.
Yes, yes. And he and my mother were, my mother, after all, was from a Southern society family in Orlando, which had settled Orlando. And they're quite an unusual couple.
Why did they marry a Jew and a non-Jew? She was Protestant or she was...
Well, the story goes that when my father was in the Army, he for some reason was sent to Orlando on an assignment. When he told his buddy in the Army he was going, the friend said, look up my fiance, Jane McGuire. And he looked her up and 2 weeks later they were married.
2 weeks later, yep. They were married.
Yep. So yeah. That's the story.
Interesting. And the other guy, did he ever forgive?
I don't know. I don't think I never heard his name again except with this story. My mother was a beauty. She was an Orange Bowl queen.
No.
Yeah. So.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did that affect you, having a mother who was an Orange Bowl queen? Not that you're not a very attractive woman.
Well, my mother was beautiful, and she was also had a beautiful soul, and she really... She was a very exquisite writer. She wrote a wonderful book, an oral history of a black sharecropper that Norton published. It was just beautiful in his dialect. She was a very unusual person.
Okay, siblings?
Yes, I have 4 siblings.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm the eldest.
And what have they done?
I have a sister who's a therapist. I have a brother who's a businessman in North Carolina, another businessman brother in New York. He's founded the Neuhaus. I think you might have heard of it. And then I have another brother who is in California who runs an art gallery for primitive art.
Wow. Now, we get to New Lebanon. Your husband's going to New Lebanon. You say, I'm coming too. I'm done with the wonderful Tenement Museum. And you go to New Lebanon.
Yes.
And then you get an idea.
Well, you know, if you drive through New Lebanon today, it doesn't look as if much is going on. And knowing we were going to stay, I set out to meet the neighbors. And everywhere I went, somebody would say, oh, you know, this used to be a great town. And now, and then they would trail off like that. And I, being a historian, I went to the library to find out whether they were right that it was once a great town. Boy, were they right. It was a town of innovation, invention, and I really discovered that the two forces that formed New Lebanon were the water, which came from this fabulous thermal spring, 73 degrees year-round, and that water swept through the valley and created this perfect environment for medicinal plants more than anybody's ever seen anywhere.
Really?
Yeah. And those plants, the Shakers used to create a very, very successful seed and medicinal business. There, for instance, their cough syrup was the biggest selling cough syrup in America, all over the country. And then Tilden's, the family of Samuel Tilden, created the first pharmaceutical factory in America there, using these same herbs. And then we had the person who invented the gradation of the thermometer. We had the founder of the first free library. It was just a bubble of innovation and excitement. And then
you were finding this out as you went.
Yes, and then we had the spa, which was run by Joel Shue, who brought the idea of hydrotherapy from Germany to New York and established a very famous spa in New Lebanon using the water. And people came from everywhere. Grant came, Lafayette came, Daniel Webster came.
Is that still there?
Yep, the spa's not there, but the water's there. That's good.
And when did it lose favor as a medicinal sort of cure?
After the Civil War, what had happened before in the 19th century, the water was discovered in the 1700s by the Indian tribes and then showed to the first European in the 1700s.
Is it different from other water?
Yes, it's been analyzed. It's got lots of herbal
content,
and I guess mineral content. What happened is that many, many Southern families came and spent the whole summer there. And not only did they come for the spa, which they couldn't afford after the end of the Civil War, so they lost a huge population of summer people, but they also came for the religion because New Lebanon was a center of religious fervor, Shakers, etc., and so much a center that when Reverend Charles Finney, who would become the president of Oberlin, was holding revival meetings in these tiny little towns, he set up a tent and 3,000 people would show up. And he was put on, essentially on trial in New Lebanon because the conventional preachers wanted to stop his message, which included that women ought to be allowed to take roles in the church, that blacks should be welcome as members, and that people should come up to the front of the church and say what they'd done wrong and ask for forgiveness from the community, on and on. They just thought these were terrible ideas.
Let me remind everybody, we're talking to a brilliant historian, Ruth Abram, perhaps better known as the founding president of Manhattan's Lower East Side Tenement Museum, and now behold New Lebanon, which is a living museum. Okay, Ruth, let's get on with it. So now you're finding this, and I keep having questions that come out of everything you're saying. So, for example, you've got this spring.
Mm-hmm.
People used to use it.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped using it.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody ever thought about recreating it?
I'm thinking about recreating it, but so are many other people in town, and that's very good. The town is reawakening, and I'm very glad about that. But then back to the story, the question you asked me. After learning this history, how important and central New Lebanon had been in the 18th and 19th century, I thought, well, it has had this experience. And when I looked at what people had done that made it famous, I realized they had taken the resources at hand, the water and the word being the religious fervor, and they had created very successful enterprises from what was at hand. And that I felt maybe that was instructive and that we could do the same.
But in the back of your head, it's the New York City Tenement Museum and what you did there, right?
Yes, I knew how to make a museum, or at least that kind of museum. So I went around town asking people, what do you know about or know how to do that urban and suburban people don't? And they just poured out the answers. I can make a fabulous slab pie. I can get my dogs to herd geese and get them off your pond or your park or your schoolyard. I can forage in the forest and come out with dinner. I'm a homesteader with my husband. I do wonderful herbal work with plants and can help you get well. On and on they went. And as I looked at the list, I saw, you know, together they form a portrait of what it is that makes up rural America today.
So if somebody said to you some of that stuff, and you took a look and you said, well, you know, I think this person may be a little, it's a Jewish word, mashugan, maybe a little crazy. Did you just say, okay, that's fine, because that's part of the fabric of the community, right?
Yeah, but I went to see it because I'm about to think about showing other people, so I had to find out what it was. But then...
Did you ever cross anything off the list and say, oh, it's just...
Yeah. Not because it wasn't interesting, but that the person just couldn't explain it in an interesting way.
Right, okay.
But however, the other thing that happened almost simultaneously was that the supervisor at the time said to me that what really would be helpful is if we could get new people involved in our community who were positive, who hadn't had their head turned and their spirits deflated by the constant failure. We don't even have a grocery store, for instance, in town right now. We don't have sidewalks. We don't have a proper sewage system. So I thought about where could I find these people, and then I thought, well, maybe there are second home owners, and the tax rolls revealed that there were 168 second homes in New Lebanon,
That's
a town
huge.
Of 2,300 people, right, yeah, huge. Yeah. So I wrote them all, asking if they would like to view the wonders of New Lebanon with me. And 60 said yes. So we went to see Cynthia Creech's Art Meters Farm, where she is raising heritage cattle called Randall cows. And I couldn't get them out of her farm. They were just fascinated. And Cynthia's famous quote is, when people ask questions about in what way she interfered with them when it snowed or when they were giving birth or whatever, she said, you know, cows know how to be cows better than people do. So it was her way of saying, you pretty much leave them alone. And we showed them the farmer's market behind the scenes and took them to the auction, and the auctioneer explained how auctions worked. Everything they saw, they were just thrilled. So now I thought, we have the makings of a real tourist attraction. We have the makings of a new kind of economic development program that is at the same time educational and important. We have the beginnings of a museum. So we applied for charter for the museum. And you know that...
Who do you apply to? The state?
You apply to the state. It's the education department, the regents, essentially. Yeah. And then all sorts of people came out of the woodwork. First comes the shed man, Gaston Roberts, and his wife, Sue, who sell gazebos. They gave us a pool house for our first visitor center, and we set it up. Then a couple who are renowned for their theatrical design work, for the Big Apple Circus, for the opera, came and did the interior gratis. Then a couple who do off-Broadway shows came and said, we'll go to see every rural guide, and we will help them present what they're doing, help them time it, help them figure out what to do with kids who wander off, etc. And everywhere we turned, somebody came to help.
Now, it's clearly there's schools in the area, right?
Schools are in the area, and our next effort will be to develop a full-blown family children program and curriculum, yes. But we first needed to get it off the ground, so we piloted it in 2014, and 200 people showed up. We had the good fortune of finding Ed and Ed Bride, and he helped us get the word out. And those people, we surveyed them. We wouldn't let them off the bus until they answered the survey. Loved it. So we knew we had a hit. And the first real year was last year, and we had, I think, 38 programs. This year we're having over 100 programs, and 50 guides are being paid to deliver these programs.
So this money comes from...
Well, first it comes from ticket sales. There's a cost to the tickets.
How much is a ticket?
It's going to be $17 this year. And you have an hour and a half program, and you get on the bus. And then Dolores Meisner of Meisner's Auction for this year, or last year, gave us a Victorian house for our visitor center. So that was so generous. And the money's coming from the Educational Foundation of America, from the J.M. Kaplan Fund, from the United States Department of Agriculture, which is thinking that this is a very good model for rural economic development. And we're thinking that too. And we're already getting requests from people who want us to show them how we're doing what we're doing, how to mine the resources of the people in their towns. So, you know, never enough money, but we're getting money. We're getting more and more people buying into this program. And we're about to have our first get-together of people who we want to interest in funding the program more fully.
Talk to me about geometry. You know, I've been through New Lebanon many, many times. And Route 20 plays a huge part
yes.
in what I think of that town.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going through, I love the Blueberry restaurant.
Yes, Blueberry Hill Cafe,
yeah,
wonderful
that's a,
place.
It's a wonderful place, and I love going through it. But in fact, you know, this road is such a presence. How do you get around that?
Well, we're hoping right now to purchase a building which is on Route 20.
Right.
And that should be just perfect. So for the summertime, it's all the people going to the Berkshires or going towards Albany either way. And for the wintertime, it's all the skiers. So that's we're hoping that this will work. We're expecting at least 1,000 people coming into town this year for Behold New Lebanon, and with Ed's help.
You're supposed to say, you don't just say, Behold New Lebanon, you're supposed to say, Behold New
Lebanon.
Well,
I like the way you say it.
There's an explanation point.
That's right, and you know that is a question people ask. Why did you name it Behold? And it's because we wanted to say, this is arresting, this is new, this is something to behold.
Well, but, you know, considering the religious background of the town.
And it's perfect for that.
Behold
yes.
is quite something.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And also New Lebanon for so long hasn't been beheld by anybody. So this is a very good place to
Now, your publicist, Ed Bride, is famous for his interest in jazz.
Yes.
What are you going to do about that? You're going to bring some jazz into New
Lebanon?
We
have jazz already. One of our country guides is a Juilliard-trained jazz pianist, and he does a great workshop in his home about how you take regular music, show tunes, for instance, and turn them into jazz.
Sure.
And what that is, he deconstructs jazz, and people loved his program. But really, all of these programs take place not in a building, not in one building, but in the houses of the people who cook, or in the forests of people who forage, or in the forests of people who do animal tracking. And it's such, or the farms of people, of the farmers.
How about responsibility? I mean, you know, I get worried when people walk in here. I don't want anybody tripping and falling and suing the radio station.
No, you don't.
And I'm wondering whether you have the same issue.
Well, nobody's tripped yet, thank heavens.
That's not the way to look at it.
No, but we have great insurance.
I keep telling my wife, Roselle, who says it's okay to leave the door open. I keep saying it only takes once.
Well, we were so lucky that Metswood Insurance came to our aid because they really have given us a great policy and we're thoroughly covered.
Yeah, oh, that's good.
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
That's really great. So now there's always a grouch around. Somebody says, you know, it was better before. And now you New Yorkers have come up here and you're going to ruin it all and take away our authenticity. And who do you think you are?
Right. Well, there are some grouches, but they are forgetting that New Lebanon was once a powerful tourist attraction. So, in fact, we're being conservative because we're bringing it back to what it was. But we have had some people who have questioned whether people who are not born in New Lebanon should have anything to do with New Lebanon, all of this.
Absolutely. I was told when I got there, we've been there now. We got to Great Barrington in 1971, actually 1969, we first bought the house full time, 1970. And I've had people look me in the eye and say, you'll never be a native.
Right.
And I always say to them, but my kids will.
Yeah, they will. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're native. If you want to, the question is, what will you do for the town?
Yeah.
I think that's the only question to ask.
Do you ever get into it with somebody?
No, because, you know, it's just not worth it to me to spend my time battling people with retrograde ideas.
Now, there are state and local officials. Obviously, this is something, if I were a congressman or if I were a state legislator, I want to be interested in this.
Yes, and they have joined our advisory board. So Chris Gibson was very helpful, Senator
Schumer.
That's a
great disappointment, isn't it, that he's retiring?
Yes, he's a lovely man. He's just a tremendous
human
being. And his whole family is lovely. At any rate, Senator Marchione is on our advisory board. So we really, they've been wonderfully responsive to us. We've been appreciative.
Have you learned how to lobby the legislature yet? Say, give us some money?
We don't call it that. We call it talking.
That's why they call it development.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
But
we don't really get money from them. For instance, when Chris took a look at what we're doing, he wrote a letter in support of what we were doing to the USDA, that was very helpful because his imprimatur suggested that what we're doing was good.
Especially since the Republican and Republican House of Representatives.
It was great, you know.
Yeah. So when you go to potential donors, teach me something. You sit across from them and you say, you know, we'd like to have some real money from you. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Well, first, I know about your interest. I know that you're community-minded. I've already found out about you in that regard.
So you're not talking to me now. You're talking to the subject.
Whoever it is, yes. But I'll use you as an example.
Right.
And I know that you value family because I've heard you talk about your family. Mm-hmm. And I know you know sort of what your lifestyle is and what you contribute to. So I will position New Lebanon for you as something that I'll probably pitch the education program because I know you're interested in education. And I'll probably say that New Lebanon has been a place where the young people are leaving because there are no jobs. And they don't want to leave. They'd rather raise their families in it, New Lebanon. So we're both an economic development program. This summer, we're only hiring local people. And that's a real boon. In the summer, we're the largest employer in New Lebanon after the track.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned the track, and I've been staying away from that because if you say Lebanon or New Lebanon, the first thing that's going to come to most people's minds is the track, the automobile track. But I haven't heard you talking about that yet either.
Well, I'm happy to talk about it because Howard Commander, who's the proprietor of the Lebanon Valley Speedway, has jumped into this feet first, and he has given tours, behind-the-scenes tours of the track, which are so popular. People want to know what happens there. And I learned a lot. For instance, I didn't know, first of all, 3,000 to 5,000 people may be there on any given night. And the track pays more taxes than anybody else in town. But what was surprising to me was that when I went, because he gave me a ticket to go, I was shocked that it was a family affair. People were bringing their whole families and spending the day and the night there. And they have a whole section, no alcohol allowed, and it's very strict. And it's for family entertainment. And I was fascinated by that. Second, the food prices were so low. I mean, really extraordinary. And I said to him, why are they so low? And he said, because these are working class people and I want them to be able to have dinner. And then the tickets are so low. The highest price, what he calls the tower tickets, were $17. And
that's what it cost for your tour.
Yeah, exactly. But you can spend all day at the track. And he was generous with his time. He became a donor. And he's just been thoughtful. And he's helped us think through, you know, potential business ideas. So while I am fully aware that there are numerous people in town who've complained about the track, particularly about its noise, I see another side of Howard Commander, and he has been useful and helpful to us.
That's great. You mentioned something that I found fascinating, because we have the same thing in Great Barrington. It used to have a lot of people who lived there, and now we have a lot of second homers. Mm-hmm. Now, second homers are potential donors and also people who go and look at your program. Right. On the other hand, there is something that turns some people off that, you know, we have lost the sense of neighborhood until the weekend comes. So maybe you could delve into that a little bit.
Well, I'm very interested in the concept of community. In my own building in New York City, where we lived, a co-op,
you still have a place in
it. Yeah, I couldn't stand the fact that, you know, some years ago, people in the elevator who I saw every day didn't speak to each other. So I began to focus on that and created, in the end, something called Vertical Village. And now in that building, this wonderful building, people go to each other's apartments to hear speakers from the building talk about whatever they know. People eat together in each other's apartments. People take trips together to go see things that they've put together. All kinds of things are happening in our building because finally we broke down this fear.
You're really something.
That you can't talk to each other.
Well, you know, you're really something. I grew up at 50 West 96th Street. There were four apartments on each floor in this 15-story building.
Yep.
We knew Mrs. Stein from across the way in the D apartment because she kept our keys in case we got locked out.
Yep.
But the other two, we never knew.
Right. Well, that's just true in
our
building.
Not in the entire time I was growing up.
And everybody said it couldn't be done. This was New York City. And I said it could. And it turned out, and this is a lesson also for country towns too, that people were afraid that if they started speaking to each other or doing things together, that they might have a conflict, and then what do? They're stuck with each other. But it turned out that you don't have to love each other. You need to be comfortable with each other. And everybody who's participated reports that they are more comfortable in the building than they've ever been before. They feel better.
It's a wonderful concept, Ruth. And I'm wondering whether or not this doesn't get made into a book somewhere.
Yes, I think it should be.
You should write this book.
Okay, but I can't write now, Alan, because I'm working on the whole new Lebanon.
You have all of these big buildings where this concept could really be applied, but taking it back home to New Lebanon.
Yeah. So the people who were not involved in the town generally were second homeowners. When I collected their names, I took them around town to the residents, full-time residents, and they did not know them. And that just gives you a sense of how separate they had been. And it turned out, really, that many of the second homeowners very much wanted to find a way into this small country town, but they didn't know how. They didn't know, could they go to the town picnic? Would they be welcome, or would they be made to feel like outsiders? What are those programs at the library? I don't know if I should go. All these questions about fitting in and wanting to be part of it. So Behold New Lebanon has given them a way to join in and to meet their neighbors, their country neighbors, and discover that they have things in common. Now, on the flip side, many of our rural guides said when we started this, well, what are these people going to think of us? We don't have little picket fences around our farms. They're mucky and dirty, and, you know, we've got pigs here, for heaven's sakes, and they're going to make fun of us. And I said, no, they're not. They're going to love it. And they did, of course. And then the guides discovered that not only did the visitors love seeing them in situ, but also that their questions were good and interesting, that they were respectful and even in awe. You mean you homestead and everything you use again and you make a whole cycle of use and reuse? Wow. Or you mean you can come out of the forest with a whole dinner that was delicious? We loved it. And it just thrilled. And it is thrilling. And, you know, it made many people feel that if they've ever thought, could I live in the country? Maybe I could, or maybe I couldn't, you know.
You're alive. Why are you getting this award, the Herbert H. Lehman Award? Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know a lot about it, but I know that the chair of the board of the Herman H. Lehman Award is a man named Kenneth Jackson, who wrote the Encyclopedia of New York. And he's a major historian on the urban and suburban experience. He wrote a famous book called The Crabgrass Frontier about suburbia, the growth of suburbia. And I had a very interesting experience when I first met him because he brought a class of graduate students to the Tenement Museum, and I gave them the tour. And Ken has taught about tenements and Lower East Side life and immigrant life for all his career. He's a renowned historian. And he got into the rooms of the tenement, 325-foot square, one window in the whole apartment, one source of air in the whole apartment. And he turned to me and he said, I've taught this all my life, and until now, I've never understood it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that was such an interesting thing.
So when did you get the call you were getting the award?
I guess a few months ago.
Yeah.
It was very thrilling.
Yeah, well, it is thrilling.
Yeah.
Is your story basically finished with New Lebanon in terms of, I don't mean you're going to die.
Thanks.
You're not, but is finished with New Lebanon, or do you have your eye on something else?
I always have my eye on something else.
I told you to write a book about vertical integration.
I would love to write a book about Vertical Village. Yeah. I would love to work on developing businesses. We are trying to fund Behold New Lebanon through the development of businesses which grow directly out of the work we're doing.
So give me an example.
Here's my favorite example.
Okay.
We have three animal trainers in town, and I was at lunch with them and thought that what they were saying about how they trained and thought about training animals could apply to human beings. So I asked them whether they thought so, and they all said yes, that if you learn to train a dog, you would be better at managing and living with another human being. I said, like what? How? And they said, well, when you train a dog, you have to be explicit and clear about what you need and want.
Mm-hmm.
And right here is where human relations often break down. People can't tell each other what they need or want. When you have told the dog what you need or want, and the dog doesn't do it, you don't say, "You creepy animal, you never understand me, you never listen to me, you try to undermine me at every turn."
They just don't get a kibble.
That's it. You say, "I must not have said this right." Very good. Then you also know from the beginning you want your dog or your partner to succeed in pleasing you, and so you set up incremental successes until they get to the end and they're a great success, and you praise them all the way. I wrote up the conversation. We brought in a man who used to be the HR director for 6,000 employees and had him visit all the animal trainers. And we said, "Do you think there's the nub here of a completely different kind of leadership training program?" And he said, "Absolutely." Then I sent that conversation to the former head of HR for Bear Stearns and for the Limited. He said, "I think you're on to something." Then I sent it to a trainer who I hope will come join us and create the first curriculum for leadership training.
So what did you have to get over? You had three animal trainers. There had to be a certain amount of competition between them. No?
They formed a business now. Isn't that adorable? It's wonderful.
But you were the agent who sort of brought it all together.
Yeah. But, you know, all kinds of things are taking off in New Lebanon as people in New Lebanon are discovering how rich their town is. They're so proud now.
But is this true about everybody's town? Is this true about my town of Great Barrington? We live in the Dewey home. Judge Dewey's story is fascinating he was the guy who presided over the Lizzie Borden trial and drove to Springfield to be the judge. So there are these stories that you're telling about New Lebanon that exist in every community,
yes,
right?
Yes, and they need to be harvested.
Yeah.
They're wonderful stories, and they're people with wonderful skills and who are willing to share them because they love doing what they're doing. They are such passion in what they're doing. Our young farmers, we have one young farmer who runs the Abode farm, and he farms with a horse. Not because he's a hippie. He's a college-trained graduate, and he is trying to do his part to be a good steward on the land.
Mm.
And he said that one of the things he loves about plowing by horse is that it's silent. It's not like the brrr of a tractor. Mm. And he said, "I can hear the earth turn." Well, that is a value, being able to live in silence. Second, he said there's no gasoline or fumes going out and polluting the environment, and the horse is creating manure. Those are great ideas, and he is interested in spreading his ideas. So when he teaches about his work, he is proselytizing. You know, it's fascinating.
How do you know, Ruth Abram, how do you know whether somebody has got it right? I don't mean lying to you, but has, you know, sort of embellished a story that they heard somebody else tell about what somebody else told. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. When my wife, Roselle, was the head of the Alford, Massachusetts Historical Commission, mm-hmm. she decided she was going to go around and do a show about each of the oldest houses in Alford.
Mm.
And she would go and she would talk to a lady who lived in this house or that house, and every single one of them said to her, "Now, my dear, I don't want to start trouble, but my house is the oldest house in the town of Alford." And she put them all together on a tape. It was hysterical as each of confided to her that was the case. So when somebody tells you their story, how do you know if it's accurate?
Well, the only time this is going to come up is now, because we've got two graduate students from the Cooperstown Museum Studies School, and they're coming to do oral histories of each of our guides. And this is part of this effort to create a portrait of a small town today.
Sure.
And so they're going to be taking the histories, and I don't think people are going to enhance their history. I found
I don't mean that they're lying about it.
They might be mistaken, or they forgot.
I
don't think the worst thing would be to just take them at their word in this case, unless something is so fantastical that we need to look it up. You know, so they say, "I was born in town A, and it turned out to be a few feet away." I mean, I don't care. But what's most important to me is to look at how it was that these people ended up in this tiny town and made a commitment to it. Who is this town? And I think that's what, together, it will be a fascinating portrait.
Do you think New Lebanon will be the same town in 20 years as it is now?
No.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, I think when people have a town gains a sense of pride in itself. It changes almost everything. And certainly if tourists start coming in and looking at what a small town is, and we don't embellish on it, and we don't try to put up, you know, towering skyscrapers or making ourselves into something other than a small country town, that bed and breakfasts will open, lovely inns will open. We will read, I'm sure, eventually the story of the swamp is going to be told. We're trying to purchase property right now and share it with the farmer's market and the swamp.
Tell me a little about the swamp. I must have missed this part.
Oh, the Swamp Conservancy is great. The swamp is what made New Lebanon, as I explained, the water.
Sure.
And the swamp, the best way to enter the swamp is the back door of the property we're trying to buy on Route 20. And we want the Swamp Conservancy, which has been created to preserve and interpret and analyze the swamp, and make it available for public access.
Well, why would you want to go into a swamp?
Because it's teeming with birds,
otters,
and all sorts of
beavers, beautiful,
unusual plants and everything.
Yeah.
And we've got naturalists just lining up to work over our swamp. It'll be a great biology education and natural
alligators, education.
I hope so. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. So we're very excited about New Lebanon's natural resources, too.
Well, that's really great. You know what I love about this whole hour, which we spent together? I love the idea that virtually everything you're saying, and I think you're a genius, but I think everything you're saying is replicable.
Yes,
in other words, we could do it in Great Barrington. They could do it in Stockbridge.
Yeah.
There are historical commissions all over the place that could take your concept of how to do this and do it for their town. That is really the beauty of what this hour has been.
Well, I hope that that is the message that comes out, and I appreciate that you lifted up that message, because that is our message. We feel that this could, you know, the head of the Agriculture Department for United States, Tom Vilsack, has said we need a national commitment to helping people stay in their small towns. And this is a building block for that commitment.
And one of the things somebody's going to say to you, Ruth Abram, is that, you know, here's what's happened. My kid used to be able to afford to buy a house in New Lebanon, and ever since you've upgraded it the way you have, they can't stay here anymore. How do you talk to that?
You talk to that by saying that this town, once it is infused with a better economy, can afford to build lower income housing, and should. They're already talking about senior housing, and I'm so glad about that.
Yeah. Well, I've had a wonderful time.
Well, so have I. Thank you so much. You're such a good questioner.
Well, you know, I love conversation.
I can see that.
Because out of everything that comes in a conversation, something else comes out of it. Our guest has been an incredible lady, Ruth Abram, president of Behold New Lebanon, which is a type of living museum, and she's really starting something here. Maybe we should have that in Great Barrington. Anyway, great to see you, Ruth. Thank you so much for coming here. And I think it's just a wonderful thing. Do you have a website?
We do. www.beholdnewlebanon.org.
Is there an exclamation point in Behold? No. Beholdnewlebanon.org.
Yes.
Okay, that's great. For those of you who want to hear this as a podcast, you can do that by going to wamc.org. We've been listening to the wonderful Ruth Abram, who did the New York City Tenement Museum, which so many people know of, and she's gotten all kinds of awards and honors, the latest of which is the Herbert H. Lehman Prize for Distinguished Service to New York History. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.